two quotes from the lecture that I think work well at this point. And this has to do with the fact that what we're talking about here is really changing our attitude more than anything else. And the quote is from Lecture 143, "When the road to the unified principle is chosen, soon what first appeared one good and one bad ceases to be so, and one inevitably encounters good and bad on both ends. And when this road is pursued still further, there is no longer any bad, but only good. The road leads deep inside into the real self, into truth that surpasses the fearful little ego interest. This simple act of wanting the truth requires several factors, the most important which is the willingness to relinquish what one holds on to, whether this be a belief, a conviction, a fear, a cherished way of being. When I say relinquish, I merely mean questioning it and being willing to see that there is something else beyond this outlook and that conviction." So what those two paragraphs are pointing towards that I wanted to open up the discussion to is that good and bad are very commonly narrow perceptions. Okay? It's good for the next 4 or 5 years, but perhaps after 5 years or 100 years, it's not so good. It doesn't have an overwhelmingly good effect. And something that is bad for a period of time, against 50, 100 years in the future, may not be so bad. Now, I'm not talking about letting oil wells spill oil all over the planet. But even if you took that kind of simplistic and dramatic example, every time a major oil spill has occurred, things do get done. They may not be done quickly. They may not be done as well as some people think they ought to be done. But action gets taken because people get angry. So the spill itself, while you could label that bad, may produce a long-term good in that people become more aware of the beauty that was destroyed and take more care in preserving it so that 50 or 100 years later, you have fewer and fewer oil spills. So again, what we're talking about, what the guy is talking about here is bad and good are not absolute. Now the second section he's talking about is attitude. So in this attitude, the holding on to a cherished belief, any holding on of any kind will it must develop into dualistic thinking, because if this is so important that I cannot let go of it, the other thing must be a threat. And in terms of attitude, anytime you feel this, what the guide is suggesting is that you look at the other side, really deeply look at the other side, and see whether it is what you perceive it to be. Because by saying yes to this and no to that, you're in dualistic thinking. This is different from saying, yes, I have a preference for this. Yes, this is what I want to support. This is where I want to be. This is what I want to be doing. And if I find myself in another situation, I'm going to take action so I come back to this place again. That's the attitude that the guide is inviting you to develop. Now, there's another place in the lectures where this is discussed, and I remember it because I had trouble with it. And that's the first stage of the stages of commitment, which are listed as AD6 in the additional materials. And this is question number 5. And question number 5 is a different way of phrasing it that I think speaks very clearly. And question number 5 says, if you feel threatened in the process of removing a fixed prejudice, are you willing to understand the dynamics behind this fear in the process of your path work, even before you may actually dare give up the prejudice or fixed belief in question. Now, what I find humorous about that question is that in formal programs, when there's going to be a commitment ceremony and you're looking at whether or not you want to take a stage of commitment, inevitably, this is understood as, if you believe in something, you've got to give it up. That's the translation. Okay? But that's not what it says. It says, if you feel threatened in the process of removing a fixed prejudice, and right there is the key. If you see a prejudice in your thinking pattern, and you can, and that makes you feel threatened, there's dualistic thinking going on here. Stages of commitment are about, would you be willing?
Oh, I'm sorry, I can't hear. There's a lot of static, and you're completely gone, Jan.
So I'm going to start over that bit. And yes, if somebody is on a cell phone or if there's noise in the background, if you could mute with a star 6.
That's terrible.
Oh. Okay, let's hope. Thank you. I was aware of it, but I wasn't certain how much it was affecting other people, so I didn't know whether to stop or not.
Thank you so much.
Let me go back a bit. The phrase from the stages of commitment is, if you feel threatened in the process of removing a fixed prejudice. Okay? The presumption is that you know that there's a prejudice. There's some place where you're holding on. And in the process of taking a look at it, you feel threatened. The stage of commitment here is saying, would you be willing to look at it? Not give it up, not let it go, but would you be willing to look at what's going on? Rather than when you feel threatened, simply hold on tighter. That's really what this lecture is about. That without realizing it, dualistic thinking becomes mine, mine, like the seagull in Nemo, Finding Nemo. Beautiful onomatopoetic interpretation of seagull crying. It's mine! Anytime that you grab something and you say, if I give this up, all will be lost, you're in dualistic thinking. And the reason I picked tiny examples is that it is in the tiny examples that our dualistic thinking begins to build up. In other words, if we're calcifying, if we're beginning to build up a position, it's not going to build up overnight into, I don't like vanilla ice cream, or I don't like people from this continent, it's not going to show up right there. It will show up in very, very subtle ways over long periods of time, so that when we finally make the last step into dualistic thinking, it sounds rational, it sounds reasonable, and it's supported by a lot of other choices we make. And that's why when I work with people, you can hit the big things, and that's very, very important, but the big things are made up of little things. Okay, the big stuff is made up of 1,000 dualistic decisions, so that when you finally say, I won't do this because that is dangerous or wrong or scary, you don't even see it as dualistic. That's only reasonable. But when you go back down to, I want to hold the job because it makes me, I'm comfortable where I am and I don't want to change, that could be more true than you might realize. I remember I went through 1 year. I got fired 3 times. It was very painful, and I felt very bad about it. But in the rest of my life, I've never been afraid of being fired because I got it 3 times. I learned how to handle being fired. It doesn't kill you. So it does disrupt, and it is painful, and you've got to find another job. But I can't explain it. I was just never terrified of being fired again. It was just part of my reality. Sometimes you get fired, sometimes you don't. Just like, actually, I was an employer also. And even people said, I want to talk to you. I was always terrified that they were going to give me notice. Because without, if you think about it, the employer can fire you or you can fire the employer. And they are sometimes just as afraid of being fired by you as you are by them. And it was hard for me when somebody said, we have to talk. I didn't know where they were coming from. I wanted to gain the advantage. I wanted to feel secure. I had no idea what they were talking about. Instead of saying, what do you want to talk about? What is your need that you have finally brought to me? Thank goodness, and now we can discuss it and see if I can meet your needs. From a unitive place, if I cannot meet your needs as an employer, I should encourage you to go on. From a unitive place, if I cannot meet the needs of my lover, love would dictate that I release them and encourage them and support them in moving on. And if you take the unitive attitude towards yourself, it's not that I'm bad, but it may be true that I, in my life circumstance, with the choices that I have made, am not able to meet that person's needs. I can see where we've got an irrevocable conflict here. But when you take a dualistic point of view, which is, you're not giving me enough time to explain myself, and you like other women better than... That's dualistic. People leave relationships for a variety of reasons, but if someone chooses to go, it is not necessarily because you've done anything wrong. Sometimes both of you have outgrown the relationship. These are the different attitudes that you can cultivate by taking a more unitive perspective than a dualistic perspective. So, are there any other questions? I always ask that with great fear because if there are no questions, I don't know what to do. And sometimes, as big as this lecture is, that's about all I can help with. let me say this. 143, Unity and Duality. If you get that, you get all the lectures. There isn't a single lecture where the guide is not talking about dualistic attitudes creating conflict and a unitive attitude dissipating that conflict or offering you another perspective, another opportunity. So normally I don't teach this by itself because I teach it in little tiny drops throughout all the other lectures.
Jen?
Yes?
Yeah, sorry, it took me, a few seconds to get the phone unmuted. I do have a question for you. I guess one of the things I'm wrestling with as I, continue to work with these concepts is that fine line between when are you trying to force things, and that's been one of my things is to try and force stuff, versus when are you allowing things to flow and recognizing that, nope, this isn't really for me anymore, this isn't the place I'm supposed to be, versus when is it, well, I need to just try a little harder. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I still wrestle with that quite a bit.
So the key, there's two keys in this. One is that anytime you do something out of fear, there's a very good possibility that you're in dualistic thinking, even if you're making the right choice. You see, just because you do something out of fear doesn't mean you're not right. And by right, I mean appropriate decision under the circumstances. The problem is that when fear prompts us to make certain decisions, by the 102nd decision, we seem to think that fear is a good indicator of what not to do. So we actually embrace fear. We bring it on board as an advisor I've made 102 decisions, and every time I walked away from fear and into something else, it was a positive thing. But that's a very, not sure what words to use here. It's a very simplistic way of looking at something, and it brings fear into a position of trusting it. Well, what is the fear about? What we're suggesting is not changing your decision, but making it from a place of fullness, making it from a place of love and acceptance, rather than choosing something over what you are afraid of. The second thing is, anytime you feel that there's a force or a push, lecture 77 is on self-confidence is the best lecture to read about forcing currents. That anytime you're in a forcing current, you're running away from something. What this lecture is about is trying to find what you're running away from so that you can turn around and examine it and get to know it, because you may have misinterpreted. When you're running away from something, you're not looking at it. Now, there's a difference between a forcing current and positive aggression.
Right, and that's what, to me, is challenging, is understanding that fine line and truly knowing which one you're doing.
Well, if you examine it and you're not running away from something, then unless distortion is, unless something is being manifested, a conflict of some kind, why not just believe in yourself? So in other words, a forcing current will inevitably get you in trouble, because it's a running away from, disguised sometimes as running towards. Okay?
Right.
But positive aggression would only be present when you needed to push. And then when the need to push is no longer present, you would relax. Forcing currents don't relax.
So let me give you a hypothetical example based on what you just said to see if I'm kind of getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if there was somebody I was attracted to, positive aggression would be letting them know I'm interested.
Mm-hmm.
Forcing would be where they say, not interested, and I continue. would that be an example?
Very good example, yes.
Okay.
There are cases where people have had to step out from themselves, where they've had to be more forward or more open than they are comfortable being, because otherwise they don't get noticed by the other person.
Right.
And that you can make mistakes when you do that. So if you take yourself out of your comfort zone and put yourself in a situation where you're very uncomfortable, where you're somewhat ignorant, you're not familiar, you're not feeling positive about yourself, very likely you can make a mistake. And yet, that may be the only way you alert the other person to your level of interest.
Ah.
Now, from a unitive place, if you do that and you drop your fork, and they look at you and say, ooh, yuck, she dropped her fork, that's probably not your guy in the first place. Okay? Because if you drop a fork when you're nervous, you're going to do that at other occasions.
Right.
So it actually, when you step out of your comfort zone and you are awkward, isn't that what romantic comedies are all about? People behaving imperfectly and yet finding that they rather like each other anyway.
Dan, can you go back to the beginning of the lecture when you were talking about when we see repetitive things or we're attracted to something that is perhaps good or not good for us? It was very, very interesting for me. It was the first time I had ever heard of it, heard of this particular way of looking at something, and I was wondering if you could just reiterate on the concept of that, of being able to perceive something differently.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm talking about? It was what you first started the lesson with. You see, I didn't grasp the whole thing. That's why I can't explain it intelligently.
That's okay. There's two possibilities here, and I'll name them both.
Okay.
What the guide was saying was there were two reasons for dualistic thinking. Okay? One is to actually believe in duality, to buy the story. But the other way to fall into dualistic thinking is to attempt to bring the unitive to this planet full-time.
Yeah, it's the second one.
Right. So that sounds like a positive when it's actually a negation. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, all our representations of God in statue form are to some degree silly. Okay, as if anybody knows what God looks like. Okay? But we like symbols and we like to look at things, so artists and societies can't help but try to give a focal point. Okay? And they try to bring that focal point into alignment with their values so that when they look at the thing, they feel the feelings of looking at God. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that can't be real. God can't be in stone. God can't be oils on canvas. God is too big for that. The unitive is like that. It's too big. The unitive does not have carpet that shows coffee stains. Okay? The unitive does not have imperfect people with personality problems trying to work out their distortions.
Right.
Okay?
Right. So when you gave the example before about a person who grew up with a messy household, and for them, for that person, the messy household was their order. And
mm-hmm.
someone who grew up in an orderly home saw the mess as a mess, not as order. So
right.
does it? So it comes down to our perception of life at the moment, of our situation, of where we are, or it's our perception.
Yes, it is our perception. I'm going to separate these two subjects. Okay, so I want to let me tie off the one to go to the second. So when we are insistent on the unitive, where that connect with the story about somebody being messy and somebody being orderly, is
yeah.
one of them would feel that there was a right way and a wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
To some extent, they're saying the right way is what the unitive would do if it were here. Those may be awkward words. But when we say the right way from a spiritual perspective, we're trying to say God's way. But when you say God's way and you talk about clutter in a cupboard, this is silly. Okay, God doesn't have cupboards.
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're doing is we're attempting to make the unitive obey the laws of nature, the laws of gravity, Newton's laws. But the unitive doesn't do that. The unitive just is. So what the guy is referring to is that when we insist on the unitive and we become angry or to some extent dysfunctional with the duality of human existence on the earth plane, we are actually being dualistic. They aren't separate. They are the same. They are part and parcel of each other, not distinct.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when we try to make them distinct, such as, I wish I could die because then I would be in a holy place, and right now I'm in the middle of a street and that's not holy. Who says that's not holy? Who says you're not doing God's work by walking down the street?
So that's where coming in and walking the middle, going the middle path,
mm-hmm.
it neutralizes the and or, the good, bad, the right, wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the exercises that you can do in your personal life, and I tease about this being a spiritual practice because you got to practice, is one of the things you can do is notice all the little tiny dualities in your life and try
mm-hmm.
to put an and in there. It's actually hard work. We all have fixed prejudices. We all have places in our lives where we believe this is the way it ought to be. Okay? And that's why I read the thing from AD 6, is in the smallest as well as the greatest parts of your life, if you are unwilling to address a fixed prejudice, prejudice meaning prejudged, I have already decided that this is right or wrong, good or bad, life-affirming or deadly. If I'm not willing to look at it, and the guide says you're not being asked to give it up or change your mind, but when you say, I won't look at it, the question would be, why? Why would you not examine? So the question before was, how do you tell the difference between a forcing current and positive aggression? Because positive aggression, even if it's turned on a little bit longer than it needs to be turned on, doesn't mind you turning it off. Forcing currents won't be turned off. You see, they're running away from death.
Mm-hmm.
Positive aggression is simply corralling some energy and force to move through something. And once the movement is made, you stand up, you dust yourself off, and look around saying, okay, I did that. Now what can I do? But a forcing current, to some degree, is still running. I have a body sense of a lot of these concepts. Some people feel it in their body, and some people are more intellectual, and some people feel it in their heart. But I have a kinesthetic sense. And I just have this feeling that something's back there chasing me. That's how I sense it. Well, that's not positive aggression. That's not moving towards something. That's moving away from something. But one of the reasons this work is a little hard, perhaps harder than other disciplines, is I can't tell you how to do it.
You're right.
What I can suggest is that there are different techniques for discovering whether you're in a forcing current or whether that was simple positive aggression. I can offer techniques of making these two column pages for you to look at an attitude and see, are you really affirming life or are you trying to avoid death? And in the helpership training that I did, you have to learn a little bit by rote when you start. So it's handy to have a list. They'd give you a list. It's called the 15 steps. And they were very, very useful to get you started when you weren't used to looking for things. But number one on the list was to look for dualistic thinking. When somebody comes to you and says, I have a problem, and you say, what is your problem? What would you like help with? And the person says, that person is a problem. Well, now we have dualistic thinking. Instantaneous. Instead of, there's an issue that I want to discuss, and this is an element of it, we've already identified the person responsible. So this person would not be looking at all angles. They've already identified the culprit, and they want you to help. Let's fix him, and then I will be okay. That is the genesis of a lot of interpersonal conflict.
Global conflict.
Pardon?
Global. It's global conflict.
Yes, that's quite true.
Yeah.
And again, if you go global, while it may be true, it can be a little numbing sometimes to think in terms of global conflict. And one of the reasons I love the Patrick lectures so dearly is what I hear from the guide is that if you're called to do mediation for world peace, you go right ahead. But if I'm not called to run for office or become some big player in this, that doesn't mean I'm not doing my work and God's work. But what I do needs to be real, and it needs to be done passionately and with every fiber of my being. I may have a small part in the plan of salvation, but I have a part. And I accept that other people may have more visible roles, But that's only on this planet. From the unitive level, no one is more important than anyone else. So from a unitive place, if you feel that your role is in gardening, perhaps the people who see those flowers and who it uplifts their spirit and they walk along whistling and feeling better during the day, maybe your role is, not maybe, your role would be more key than you would realize. And that any analysis that says I'm not as important as someone else is, to some degree, dualistic thinking. It's dividing the world into movers and shakers and the rest of us. And on a unitive level, that's not true. That's what the guide says.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? So I am learning that the teleconferences don't need to be as long as they have been. In the beginning, I was preparing a lot of material, and I have a capacity to go on and on and on. So it's been suggested by a couple of people that an hour and a half is a very nice chunk of time, and that it would do quite nicely, thank you. So I'm going to let that happen. And I appreciate all of you being here and participating. It's a lot more fun for me to talk to real-life human beings than just go on by myself. I sincerely appreciate your questions and appreciate them. If you have any other questions, you're welcome to email me. The next teleconference, I messed up on the invitations and sent out... anyway, January 17th is going to be about the function of the ego. And to some degree, it's a follow-up from unity and duality. So unity duality is kind of setting the stage for the unitive versus the earth plane and how we can be on the earth plane and yet learn this middle ground. And the lectures on ego, specifically 132, the function of the ego, talk about what we need to be human beings in order to inhabit our spiritual path and really live the life we're meant to live on this planet. And that ego is a primary portion of that. A bit different than sometimes other spiritual philosophies present the ego to be. So that will be on the 17th. And thank you again for participating.
I just want to say again that it sure helps those recordings. So that I don't seem to respond very much sometime in the initial presentation here, but going over it again certainly helps. So I'm going to send you an email about some of that.
Okay. That'd be fine. Glad to have it. So other than that, everybody have a very happy new year, and hope to talk to you again on the 17th. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jen. Bye.
You're very welcome.